Yeah. I mean, did a few times. I've spoken to people.
Yeah, I remember you shoot a day.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a great source of pleasure. I believe this is the third year in a row that we're zochet to have Rav Lavyansky Shlita. I actually happened to have heard the reinstated of his brother-in-law, Rav Gerner Vassensky Finkel. I actually was passing by Ramat Shemesh one day, and I heard your voice, and I stopped to hear the hesped. And then I also heard the hesped in the area of the Mir Yeshiva. And I heard a third hesped I heard as well on a tape that someone gave me in my car. And really, it was absolutely moving, each one of them, each one of the hesped that I heard. But in general, Rav Lavyansky is the Rosh Yeshiva in Silver Spring, Washington, and Maryland, actually. Not sure which state it belongs to. I think it's Maryland.
Maryland.
Whatever the case is, he's really an outstanding role model for many, many people. And I still am amazed that Rav Lavyansky left Eretz Yisrael. I still can't get over it. And he left Eretz Yisrael, where he clearly is a integral part of the Mir Yeshiva. He left Eretz Yisrael, and he went to establish the Yeshiva in Chutz Laretz, become part of the Yeshiva in Chutz Laretz, and really he's had the tremendous Hatzlacha. And all those who really have are considering learning in a small yeshiva, which has really beautiful contact with Rabbeim and Yeshiva, with the Rosh Yeshiva, really, it's kedai to get to know Rav Lavyansky, and Baruch Hashem, today we're zocha to a Q&A, question and answer session, so feel free to ask questions in any particular area that you may desire, and I'm sure you'll be quite satisfied with the responses you're going to receive.
First, let me just add, Rav David himself raised a question, and I think it's fair enough to give an answer about leaving Eretz Yisrael and Kapuzot. He actually asked it the Lashon Tmiya. He said he's amazed. And I do want to share a sentiment. It's a personal thing, obviously. I was in Eretz Yisrael, Zochet to be Eretz Yisrael 25 years, and most of my children live in Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, it's not easy to leave. I just want to share in 1 minute, just when I made a Chnukis of Ayas of Chutz Laretz, I had very mixed feelings about making Chnukis of Ayas of Chutz Laretz. You know, Simcha Zuma Osef, if you left Eretz Yisrael, so a house in Chutz Laretz.
Some you made without a bracha.
Well, there was a lot of foods. I should have benched, I should have washed, there was a lot of brachas involved. But, and I just, it's, you know, we're learning the Sedris, the Klai Yisrael on the Midbar, and there was a certain guiding principle of Al Pi Hashem Yachnu, Al Pi Hashem Yisu, and it says, the Gemara says, Kivn Al Pi Hashem Yachnu, Hashem Yisu, Keman Dekvi Damye. And it was, my beliefs are that Shevet Levi, which means the people who've undertaken to be involved in Harbatzis Torah and so on, their mission is akin, they don't have a Nachla because their Nachla is Hashem. Which means that sometimes you have to take a longer trip than you want, and to maybe a place that's not, I mean, Baruch Hashem, still is a wonderful place, but I'm saying, you know, if the calling arises, you need to be prepared to leave your Yerushalayim and go wherever, you need to be sure that that's where Hashem sent you. But once that piece is in place, the calling of going out, and it's something I think it's a challenge for our door, leaving Eretz Yisrael is one challenge, but people who live in very big Torah centers, people live in Lakewood, New York, and then they sometimes have to make a choice to go out of town where there are lesser ruchnistic accommodations. There's also an element of trying to figure out if there's a sort of a divine call to do it, and that's an issue of Hashem Hashem Yisus. So I just wanted to add that point.
Yeah.
Aha, good. Rav Noach Kazidler was your Rebbe. He was from the Gaon Emir. Yes, okay, so who's taking the questions? Who's the moderator? Who's the just question? Okay, fine. So he's a local, he's from the area, he's Fairfax, Virginia, falls under the jurisdiction of Yeshiva Gedolah Washington, so we're good to go. We actually have, one of the things we do is we have a program once a week in his area, in the Chabad, where we learn, boys learn Chavrusas, Shiurim, and things like that. It's and quite a few of the boys have come to the Yeshiva, so it is a very strong cache, yes.
This may be controversial with regards to because a lot of the bamboos, but why the black hat? Is it more a minhag from ancestry, or is it more, for a lot of people, just a way to show your ashkach, or which way you lean?
Okay, so you fixed on the black hat. I don't think many people wear a longer suits today, unless they're very in a very suit-oriented career. I don't think many people say don't wear caftans and so on. So let's talk a little bit about the items of levush and the general hashkafa. One element was, anytime there's a change, why do we dress in fashion? Because, you know, everyone's got their closet of clothing, and there's a certain sense of wanting to belong in society. If something is out, then wearing it is a statement that you're a misfit, that you got your clothing at a thrift shop. There's a certain statement where you're not keeping up, or you're clueless. You know, there's always in every suit store, there are those light yellow and pinkish striped suits that you always wonder who is the guy who buys this stuff. And there's always a guy who buys it. He's identified by that. So we're dressed a certain way, and it changes. By Hasidim especially, there was a strong sense of being cut off from society to the point that it really doesn't make a difference, and we don't want to be in step. That was the attitude of the Hasidic community, and in some ways a little bit also what we call the Yeshivish community. But the Yeshivish community, and what we call the Litvish, did adapt more, short jackets and so on, but certain items were felt to have inherent value. A hat, until 40, 50 years ago, I still remember when every important person in a picture wore a hat. President Truman, for those of you who know that America had a president called Truman, Eisenhower. Kennedy was the first president who didn't wear a hat. He was also the first president who had hair. You know, he might have been part of the sheet. It was he actually had a beautiful mane of hair to show off, whereas Eisenhower, to the best of my abilities to discern, seemed to be totally bald. Truman probably wasn't much more, but it was considered to be well dressed. It's certainly a chabadus of wearing a hat. In halacha, wearing a yarmulke, in covering your hair, it seems needs more than a yarmulke. So in a certain halachic vein, the yeshiva community has stuck to a hat for dvarim shebekdusha, for brachos, stuff like that. In the sense of expressing itself, because it was a sign of nechbadus, whereas taking off the hat, in other words, one of the things Kennedy projected was a much more casual look rather than a stiff, formal look. The sensitivity of the community was the stiff formality is part of nechbadus. So it reflects on, in a very specific area, some halachic point, and another area, it expresses a certain sense of how, you know, what is it we're trying to portray or project? That's sort of where what it is. Yes?
What are your feelings on what's going on now in Israel with the whole push for separate buses versus separate seating on buses versus mixed buses?
So, first of all, let me tell you, I guess, an anecdote. I lived in Israel for 25 years, from 1970. When I finished high school, I did Shana Aleph, and I did Shana Chafei 25 years later. The Mir has a 25-year program for the people that don't do the full course. So 95, 96, I'm there. In those 25 years, I can't tell you how many issues were there. But I was sitting with somebody, a guest of ours, and he told me, he was older than me, like a good 20 years older than me, and he told me he'd learned that song in the 50s. He said he doesn't remember when it was exactly, but he remembers that there was a big tumult about something, a big issue, and posters all over the walls. So I told him, that's easy. It could have been 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, and so on. There's always a very strong sense of things. And the reason is, I do think, one, people in Eretz Yisrael who settled in Eretz Yisrael across the board, whether frum or secular or anti-frum, had very strong shittas. In other words, people came to Israel for ideals, whether it was Shomat Zayir ideals, whether it was revisionist ideals, whether it was frum ideals, to kind of be as strict as possible, as, you know, as fulfilling, so on and so forth. So it tended to produce a drive in different directions, in extreme. That's part of nature. Even forget about the religious secular debate. In my days, and today it's not as sharp, but in my days, the left-wing, right-wing debate was extremely acrimonious. Now, in the Hasidic communities, and in Yeshiva communities in Israel, there are no situations where you push and crush together with men and women together. It's not something that halachically is the most appropriate thing. Rav Moshe has a tshuva for people who use the New York subways, which, I mean, are pretty, pretty awful. Just, I mean, it's really dense and packed together. And, you know, he's moderate because there are not no other choices. If you can have it in a way that you know, when buses get crowded and you're not crushed against a woman, matovim anoyim, it is right. How much should you make that a public agenda? How much should that become? Yeah, you know, in a way where you create so much tension. I don't know. That's an answer that I have certain feelings myself. But in other words, I feel a lot more comfortable. I don't feel comfortable in a bus when I'm squashed together with men and women together. I don't think it's logically right. On the other hand, the extreme version of where if God forbid, a lady with two little kids gets on the wrong bus because she's been sitting in the heat outside or in the cold outside, that should become a jihad, I also think is really bad. So I agree, I sympathize with the sense of it, that there should be a natural separation and people shouldn't be in a position that's very Natsniistic. But on the other hand, I obviously feel the acrimony, you know, gender, when you make it into a very, very mean type of confrontation, is bad. That's what I feel. Yes?
So, Rabbi Shrivsovov was here 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And it was basically about your toshav, and what that brought up was a prospect that basically he quoted a halakha that your toshav only applies when there's yovel. And basically, so that brought up the fact that yovel technically only applies when Rov Am is in Eretz Yisrael.
Correct.
So, my question is, are we going to be at the point at like 10, 20 years maybe when would yovel apply in the near future when Rov Am is there? Because I looked into it a little bit and it seems that there are shitas that say otherwise. And what would the implications of yovel and Eretz Yisrael be in this modern age?
Well, first of all, like you said, the most shittas, the Vestager shittas hold, it's totally with Rov Yisrael Alad Mosem. It's always hard to give an exact figure for that because we don't have good statistics for Chutz Laretz, but the trend is definitely not because there's so much Aliyah, as on the one hand there's a high birth rate in Eretz Yisrael, that's one good thing. On the other hand, lo aleinu, there's tons of assimilation in America, and not much is going to be left at some point. And all over the world, I mean, America is not the only place, in Europe and Russia and so on. I don't know, it's one of those areas that I don't know if we have someone big enough today to put down a Shulchan Aruch for it. It may be relevant for halachas of Shemitah, but a lot of other halachas that go with it. I'm not sure somebody's going to institute a rivri. I'm not sure someone is holding by. I don't know. I know, but I think you can't. It's very hard to create a Shulchan Aruch when no one's been there before. The Chazon Ish was a giant that all the halachas about Zroim were pretty forgotten. And it's very hard to go to a Gemara and construct a halachic system. I don't know, David Shahal will have Mashiach Tzidkenu and have somebody who's a Talmud Chacham enough to make it. I mean, we could say nice verses about Yovel and what we would do, but I don't think anyone today is big enough to create a Shacharach. It's astounding. I don't know, yeah. Let's get somebody else. Yes?
Would you hold it with money well spent for art school to spend millions of dollars to translate the Talmud Yerushalmi? And if so, why?
Okay. Let me ask you something. I was once sitting with somebody at a simcha many years ago. This person was a strong admirer of Begin, and Begin was the head of the right-wing Chayrut, Likud, so on party. And he was telling me with a lot of pathos, with a lot of emotion, that there's a moshav, it's a long time ago, that he said is mentioned in Tanakh, and it hasn't been reclaimed, and there are only four families living there, and how can we leave something that belongs to the nation of Israel unreclaimed, and so on and so forth. So I told him, I hear, but we have so much of Torah that's us, and it's unclaimed. Yerushalmi is part and part of our neshama. It's a complementary Talmud to Bavli. The Rambam seems to have taken a fair amount of halachas. It's definitely an important project. The hesitation that I hear from you, which I think has in itself some value, is A, is Yerushalmi something that should be learned by people who are not fluent enough in the Hebrew? Because Bavli is Gufo Torah. Yerushalmi is an adjunct. We go to the Yerushalmi sometimes to help us understand the Bavli, where there's a lacuna in the Bavli, where the Rambam chose to pass Yerushalmi over the Bavli. But it's not something that is really, if somebody has time to convey the Torah, we would not suggest Yerushalmi. And somebody who's learning full-time and has the time to put into it should not need an art scroll at that point. You know, I like the fact that someone has made an effort to bring Yerushalmi closer home and redeem it, so to speak. I think it's been done in Hebrew, and enough mepharshim have come out to make it accessible to a Talmid Chacham. Whether or not this is something that should become widespread to Hamon Ha'am, not there's anything wrong with it, but is it important? The question is, what was the alternative? The money would have been used to take kids and be makarid and kids that are really out in no place and bring them closer. Maybe that would have been better use. Maybe the person had a special reason what they showed me. So, A, I feel positive that we've made a step to bring back a part of Torah. I'm just not sure if English was the right answer for that. Yes? Back? Okay. I got somebody in the back.
I was just going to ask, if you already have a sufficient amount of money, do you think it's still necessary to have a job and do something, and like work in the world and learn exactly your subjects, or do you think you should dedicate your entire life to like learning and collab out of there?
We should all have the problem. That's one. Let's start with wishing. But I do want to address that issue seriously. It's work. People should not see. Revolva has, I think one of the things we learned about in Yeshiva is Revolva has Sfarim that are extremely structured in terms of his first part of the Sefer deals with what a Yeshiva is and different elements of it. And then in the back, the fourth part deals with going out in life and having a broader perspective. And one thing he deals with is a person's job, but he doesn't use the word job. The word he uses appropriately is tafkid. A person needs to ask himself, why did Hashem put me in this world? You know, if a person can be a very good doctor, that's something. A person can be a very good businessman if he's and use money to produce a lot more good than he could do in his own right. A person can have a very good and deep head and learn and create tremendous amounts of Torah. All of those are things that a person needs to ask himself. Having money and being jobless is a recipe a lot of times for disaster. There's a Gemara in Ksubis, I'm sure many are familiar with it. There's a Mishnah. The Mishnah says, what are a woman's duties at home? And the Mishnah lists them. Obviously not relevant today, we don't even know what they are, most of them. Very few of our wives, we hope our wives will spin wool into thread. Not the type of thing, but the Mishnah goes through all the things that they do. It says, if you're wealthy enough that you can afford help, X amount of help, this falls off. More and more. But there comes a point where the Mishnah says, even if he has money to bring in 100 servants, she must do this, this, and this. And the Mishnah is two gersos. The one brings two gersos, why? One is because sitting empty-handed makes a person crazy. And the second one is because it brings a person to Aveira. When a person is home bored, and doesn't have what to do with themselves, they either develop mental emotional problems or they begin looking for trouble. And most of the people on drugs are, more people on drugs are there because they have too much money than they have too little money. It's unfortunate when people are bored. A person never should be in a position, if his learning, in the Mir Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva was Reb Lazy Yudel, and Reb Lazy Yudel was the founder of the Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, and he always demanded from Bachrim more learning. He never was happy. Always, if you knew 100 plat, he would grumble and say, when I was your age, I knew 200 plat. If you had a shtickle Torah, he would say, when I was your age, I already had a sefer. You know, he was always demanding and pushing and really, really getting a lot out. So someone told me, he went down, you know, when you get the exemption from the army draft, it's called Toroso Umnaso, meaning your profession, your trade is Torah. So he looks at it, very kind of, you know, very, so see, like, looks at it the first time. So he reads it, Tarasim Nasa. He says, the Mishnah says that a woman is kona b'shvach kelim, meaning the definition of a craftsman or trade is someone that improves something. He takes wood and makes a table out of it. You need to, a tradesman is not someone that just takes something, buys and sells it. You've got to actually create some sort of improvement in it. So he said, maybe the army holds that umen kene b'shvach kelim, that in order to be considered a tradesman, you have to actually have made some improvements. I need to hear from you a shtickel Torah to see if you actually have some input that created something. You know, a person needs to feel creative. A person needs to feel that he's accomplished. And that's it's an important personal decision that a person needs to speak over with a rav in that case. Sitting and doing nothing just because you have money, even if you're quote-unquote learning, if you're quote-unquote learning, then you're not learning. And it's not a trade. It's not. It has to. The learning has to be at the level of, this is your life's calling. Ashrei a person that has that. But if a person is kind of just floating because he has the luxury of the money, that's a terrible thing. Yes? Okay, sorry. Good. Yeah, good.
So, being in yeshiva, you're fortunate to hear a lot of different opinions from different rabbis.
Yeah.
Whether, for example, you know, you should learn all day, or you should, you know, go get a job, or you should live in Israel, or not live in Israel. How is one supposed to reconcile these different opinions? Because, I mean, God is a plan for us, and God, there's always an optimal way that we should live our lives. But a lot of these different opinions can be contradictory. How can they all come from very reputable sources?
Right. So let me sort of give a parallel to it, and then let's explain how we can apply it. In the old days, people were born into tribes, and every tribe had a dominant calling. So Zvulun was Al-Chof Yamim, and Asher was Shmein Alachmo, and Levi was Mishrasi Hashem. Each tribe had its own calling, and the way it worked was by inheritance, just the children were kind of the same nature and so on and so forth. At some point later, the Goyen says in Mishlei that people would go ask a prophet what their calling should be, and he would tell them. We don't have that. A person needs to choose a derech. In other words, this is the first year, I assume, that you've been exposed to so many different shittas, rabbanim, etc., and so on. All of it is true, but the question is, where do you belong? And, you know, when a person, by the time a person finishes his formative years, he should feel that he's part of a certain tzibur, part of a certain kehillah. For myself, it's the yeshiva world in general, and the mir in particular is my tzibur, my kehillah. Another person might gravitate to yeshiva university, and if he finds a person, a rav, that by and large, he feels this is his derech. You listen whether it's easy or whether it's difficult. Once you feel this is your derech, there are going to be decisions that you're going to have to make that you don't like. But you can't pick and choose on individual things because then you're cheating. But you can choose. A person might be nimshach to chassidus, and he finds in ger the warmth, the fire, and the enthusiasm for Yiddishkeit that's real, and he becomes a ger chassid. It has to be with a real evaluation of where you belong. In chassidus, a job used to be where your sherish of neshama is. And then you have to be prepared to follow it all the way, because on the details, You're cheating if you say, okay, I'd like to do this like them, that's the other one. That doesn't work. But you need to find what speaks to you and where you belong. Yes?
Well, so how do you know you're doing it for the right reasons? Because it's very easy to pick a different shkita based on convenience. Like, so that was a good example of that. You see a lot of fire and chassidish. But what are exactly the right, what should you be looking for when you're finding your tequila?
You should feel a group of people that you feel are b'nei aliyah, a rav, a manhig that you feel is emes, and you know, and is recognized as such. If everybody else thinks that this person is off the wall, and you know, then you should. You have immediate rebbeim, Baruch Hashem, well qualified to be madrich you, and tell you what's reasonable and what, and you know, what are things that are crazy or don't make sense for you, or just a momentary exuberance or a momentary weakness. And that, listen, there's nothing else. Hashem will only ask of us what we can do. Nobody can know for sure. But if we're really honest with ourselves, and it's a process, anything that you do in an instant is possible. Anything that's a process over time, and you speak with rebbeim that you respect and trust, which Baruch Hashem you have here, and they will help guide you, you know, towards a direction that's appropriate for you. And that's emes. Yes.
Okay. So, luckily, a lot of us will have the chance to go to Poland by around Pesach time.
Right.
And recently, we just had a pre-Poland.
By the way, my mother's from Poland, and she doesn't think it's so lucky to go there. So, okay, yes.
We're hoping to go back and see everything.
Yes, but, it is a great, yes.
Whatever it is. So, we had a pre-Poland talk about why go back to the camps.
Yes.
And in your opinion, why go back to the camps?
Go ahead.
What?
You're assuming.
No, I do.
If you do.
No. I think in general, there's a concept called Noseh Bolam Chaveiro, which means if a tragedy or difficulty strikes any part of Klal Yisrael, you need to feel part of it. Your reaction to somebody else's house caving in shouldn't be, Baruch Hashem, my house is sound and it's not going to cave in. That shouldn't be a reaction. Reaction should be, I mean, this is an incredible churban where, you know, Klal Yisrael was destroyed in a horrendous way. The idea of being part of it, understanding that whether you like it or not, you're a son of that tragedy, you're part of it, I think is a tremendous bonus. More than anything else, to feel that way. I have something that I speak about every Tisha B'Av. The Siva B'Av stays around pretty much the summer. And Tisha B'Av, I always, when I get to the kinnis about the Crusaders, there's a tefillah that we say once a week that's the most maligned tefillah. It's a tefillah that, you know, if I need to pick a time when I should step out for a minute, it's obvious, halachically, this is the best time to step out. And that's Avarachmim. Avarachmim, no isa to be mafsik, no kedusha, it's the latest of all the tefillahs. Anything you want, any heta you want, for talking, schmoozing, going out for a moment, that's the right time. But Avarachmim is a tefillah that was made to remember what it was like when kehillas were destroyed as kehillas. And I want you to use your imagination a little bit. Look around a shul. Look around a community of a few hundred people with kids laughing, running around, a kiddush waiting, women coming to pick up the kids. And as a kehillah, the entirety being shechted out chas v'shalom. That's a varachmim. You know, zakas anovim leishachach, every Shabbos, we sit down for a moment. Shabbos is the time for the kehillah. It's the time for everybody to be together. And it's the time when you get the beauty of the kehillah, you know, the kids and the husbands and the wives and the niceness of the kehillah. And this was butchered and time and again. And you need to sit and remember it. I mean, after I spoke about it, I have a very hard time. And I try to figure out halachically what's the next best place if I need to step out. But it's really something. We're not, Baruch Hashem, we grew up in a society where very little was missing. If God forbid we were the third on the block to get the iPad, then we have real sense of being, of suffering life. That's as far as we go. But understand, 50, 60 years ago, going back hundreds of years, being butchered out was there's a sefer, it's written by somebody, Burenfeld. It's called Sefer Tumos. It is three thick volumes like this. Literally, I have it at home. I couldn't buy it. I can't afford to collect these items. I ran it off the Yitzhak Hochman, bound it because I wanted it. Three volumes listing personal accounts of every gzeira and redifa and sarah that hit Klal Yisrael. Only. What's fascinating about it is the Hakdama. The Hakdama is that, you know, when I sat down to write this, I thought that all this butchery and barbarity had come to an end, and you know, now we have a civilized world and a new world, and things are different, and you know, and yet we still have all the things like this going on, and who would think that in a modern civilized world this could still be happening? Signed, Berenfeld, 1924. He didn't know that the next 10 volumes were about to be written. And this is three volumes this thick. And you can run over, if you have Otsa Chachma, you can find it, and it's mostly first-hand material. And this is 1924, where he says, I can't imagine that in the 20th century, which is civilized, there'd be pogroms in the early 1900s here and there and the other thing. This is us. This is our grandfather and great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather. And being oblivious to it is a terrible, terrible thing. And I think it's important to be part of it. You know, that's, and to no sipa ol more than anything else. If you see somebody else, no sipa ol doesn't mean you have to help the person alone. If you're going through a terrible tkufa and the other person is happy, go lucky, hi, what's going on? Good, you know, here's some other time for you. Person's going through a terrible operation and it's life and death or is his beloved one or whatever. And a guy breezes by and says, hi, what's doing? Well, I have some, you know what, I'll hear about it later. I'm on my way to a concert. See you. Bye. What would you feel about the person? I mean, this is where we are, and we need to see ourselves as part of something much bigger. And I think going to there, just thinking about how many children and how many people and how much of us, they were all us. And we're part of that branch. And to think about it, close your eyes and to imagine it and understand what it means. And then to see Niflaus Sabori, that 60 years later, Klal Yisrael's never had it so good and we're flourishing. I always point out, any intelligent person, if you're to ask him in 1945, what's the future of Klal Yisrael, and especially Torah Jewry, anybody with a drop of seichel in his mind would say, gone, history, next. Eastern Europe was gone. Eretz Yisrael was a fragile, fragile little nothingness, barely surviving. That's the truth. America was on the way assimilating out. Conservative Jewry was about the best America had. Orthodoxy was on the way out. I mean, I know from Rabbanim who became conservative because they were convinced nothing would happen. Reform is the best that would happen. And conservative would be ultra-Orthodox someday. That was, you know, that was their feeling. That was it. And 60 years later, we have buildings and neighborhoods and cities and yeshivas, 10,000, 5,000. I mean, numbers are incredible. You know, think about it. It's if you take a little time and digest it, it's incredible. Yes?
Should we as Talmidim, not necessarily teaching Torah, but learning Torah, push harder to learn Eretz Yisrael versus America? Or is it similar or different?
So, in the chinuch that I grew up with, and again, you know, like he said, there are different approaches. The chinuch I grew up with, the most important criteria for determining where to learn would center around the quality of the learning. It happens to be, and maybe for many other reasons, that Eretz Yisrael, by and large, has that quality. An environment like this that's created what I think is a revolution for much of American boys out of high school, a lot of it has to do with Eretz Yisrael. A lot of it has to do with the fact that it's not in America. You know, today everybody's everywhere at the same time, it's taking away from it. But so I see it, the chinuch I have and the hashkafa I have is the quality of learning is the important piece, and all the other factors need to fit into place. Obviously, if it's fairly close, Eretz Yisrael Mitzvah Atzma has a Maila. But if a person has a reasons why the learning would for him work out much better there, then my sheath is my background would be the Tefei B'chutz La'aretz. But by and large, Eretz Yisrael does produce Torah like no other place. Let me make it someone else who has that. Anyone else? Yes?
If Chas V'Shalom, Israel should find themselves in a war, should people are guys my age, should we volunteer for the war, or should we stay and learn, or should we go back to America for safety?
That is one of the most difficult questions, and I would say it's a question that you need to ask someone who knows you. If a person can make a meaningful contribution to the war effort, that would come first. If a person his contribution would be minimal, is more for show than anything else, and he does sit and learn, and he's serious, and the schus of Torah is certainly greatest. And then there are issues. If some parents, I mean, my parents, despite the fact that they were war survivors, and my father lost his wife and children, and my mother lost 10 out of 14 siblings, when I was here for the Yom Kippur War, and Yom Kippur War was scary, I mean, we didn't think we'd win. I mean, at first, when they told us we'd win, and then when they found out it was very scary, my parents refrained from calling me because they were scared that it would influence me to go back home. They didn't want me to do that unless I really wanted to do it. They didn't want that I should do it for them. They felt if I want to stay in Israel, I should stay. But some parents can't handle that. And for you to do some minimal help here and devastate your parents, that would be wrong. So it's a very tough question, and it needs to be answered individually by somebody that wants to take a high school. And hopefully we won't have that question. Yes?
What exactly is the process or maybe the halachic reasoning or just the minhag behind wearing a jacket or not?
So jacket also, in halacha, there's a beged elyon, you know, where it's seen as being nechba. In other words, formal attire universally includes more beged, and casual includes less beged. The wearing a beged that's sort of a shirt and an undershirt are seen as your personal garments. They're more there for yourself, and the jacket is sign of the nechbadus. When the Knesset has had, these people just up in the Knesset in undershirts, basically, and then they, because of a sort of a kibbutz mentality, and that clothing is unimportant. I don't remember how many years ago, it's been 20 years now, you have to wear a jacket when you're sitting in the Knesset. My son was once on a tiyul with a family, with a very, very large family. Part of the family was very yeshivish, part of the family was very not yeshivish. Everybody from, but it was kind of a big range. And they came to a place, this person who was a very not yeshivish person, got up to the Daven Mincha. He was wearing shorts, sandalim, and whatever. This person is a highly accomplished person. He actually worked for Netanyahu as a personal liaison of sorts in certain areas. And it's been done. And then my son made some comment to him. And he got very defensive. And he said, you know, who says this? Who says that? Who says that? And my son asked him, let me ask one question. Would you walk into Netanyahu's office like that? And he thought a minute and he said, you're right. And I will never do it again. I was very impressed with the person. It was a real intellectual honesty. A jacket, when you come to a formal occasion, you wear a jacket. And we translate that into Omer Lifnei HaMelech. Yes?
So you're saying that, maybe you're not saying this, but
my question is why I'm not saying it. No, fine.
So I was also, I heard different concerns about today, but what happens when, you know, what if it were, I guess if we're dealing with a situation, but what if it were that the...
You took off your jacket.
Everybody were going to Knesset wearing highlighter jackets or something, you know, ridiculous. Does that mean that all of a sudden we're basing our halachic activity, and not only in this area, also in Shabbos, that you can't do a Shabbos because it's general modes of travel or something. You know, are we
still
based on...
So, let me say, certain halachic sensitivities, for instance, the idea that putting on an outer garment has chashivas, a formality, is something that's almost built into the human psyche. You go to Africa, the chief has a big cloak that he puts around him. It's an informal And, you know, I it's an informal research. I can't tell you I've been in Africa and gone to all the chieftains, but when I see a picture of a chieftain, he's always wearing some sort of garment to signify his kshivas. So there's a sense in halacha that a beged elyon is machshiv a person. Which color, the stripes and so on, is less. And that's not something that is, if society were to see bright yellow as being very formal, it's very possible that would be the beged. I don't know. I don't know, really. Yes?
You want what about to? For the female society where wearing less is more formal?
What?
What about for the female society where wearing less is more formal?
It's not more formal, but it's acceptable. Again, wearing a beged, besides the problems of erva, which even in halacha, so like a tznius, you have two layers. You have one layer is certain things are halachically considered to be across the board, not tznua and so on. And then there are things that depend really on the place and the society's norms. So wearing less begadim past what is muta not to wear is also for erva reasons. It's still, the Queen of England wears very formal, and you don't expect, it's sort of a scandal when they start wearing less. It's acceptable. It's not the pshat that the formality lies in wearing less. It's despite the fact, you know, you can wear less, but it's not within itself a statement of nekbat.
So, what do you think about yeshiva guys drinking on Purim?
What do you think about yeshiva guys drinking on Purim? Well, Purim's coming up soon, and I have a yeshiva, so let me be honest and tell you where I think about it. I mean, by us, Baruch Hashem, the boys are older, they're mature, they drink on Purim, but almost never does anyone go past a certain red line of becoming not irresponsible. I mean, we've limited, our policy has been 2 bottles of wine over the Suda period. No drinking at night before, and nothing else but wine, and with the Suda. I find it enhances things when people who are baledeya, bale nefesh, drink, and they're able to become elevated. It's an elevating experience. But many people don't have that. They're either not mature enough, they've got too much going on inside, they're looking for a quick thrill, they're gulping down a half a bottle of whiskey, and the answer to that is absolutely no. So it's a very tough one. I like to try to cut it as fine as I can. I see the value in drinking, and I see the dangers in it. And one needs to know who he is and what he is. If a person knows that he's not yet responsible, then your best thing is to stay away. If you can drink very responsibly, and again, halachically, wine is what's supposed to be drunk, nothing else. And you're supposed to do it as part of the Suda. It's not a drinking fest. And if a person, what comes out of his mouth and what he does with himself and what he projects of himself is the best of himself, then I think it's elevating. If not, it's not. And yes, so. Yeah?
Just a follow-up to the previous question about learning the next 12 verses.
You're right.
I think there's some other Milo which you kind of mentioned, but about we're trying to, like, maybe not, but maybe it's not the reality is not stressful, but trying to accomplish something here in Eretz Yisrael, like building Jewish communities and getting all the Jews maybe to make Aliyah. I don't know if that's...
So, again, the general Hashgafa that I was raised with was that Talmud Torah Kinei Kulam. And the yeshiva world, my yeshiva's world, has made the most absolutely important thing is the intensity and the devotion to learning that you can do. So it is important to build Eretz Yisrael, and it's good. But again, in the termination, that's been the way. I know the yeshiva as a general, he has a little different hashkafa, so that's why I'm speaking as, you know, from my point of view.
Did the Tanan themselves and the Moran look like really strong about coming to Eretz Yisrael?
They were, but the way it was translated in halacha is minimal, and it's hard to understand why or what happened. But in halacha itself, in Shaharach, you only find it in the context of a husband and wife disagreeing about where they should live. There were two reasons. I don't want to go into that completely, but one was, it was very hard. One of the reasons why the yeshiva, the black hat yeshiva community, as you want to call it, was moved back a step from Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, was because there was a strong pull of secular Zionism, which threatened to sort of overwhelm religious Zionism. The values of living in Eretz Yisrael as a frum person would be swallowed up in just the big picture without being able to have that sense of Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael that an Ehrlich Yid has. So the yeshivas have taken a step back. I don't know where it'll settle in, and that's why it's hard to give more of a detail. Somebody else, here, yes?
Joseph and Dora got it, meant to be taken literally.
They're meant to be taken extremely seriously. Some of it is meant to be very literal, some of it is meant to be not at all literal, and some of it have double meanings. The problem is figuring out which is which. What I'm telling you is the Ramchal's Shita, the Maral's Shita. You can look at many Gaonim Shita. The dominant Shita is that the Agarata is a mixture of things. The Pasuk says in Mishlei, Divrei Chachamim V'Chidosa. Mishlei is the words of Chachamim. Chidosam is translated erroneously as riddles. It's not a riddle. The right translation of a chida is a metaphor. In other words, something that means something else. The word riddle, chuda lechidasi, by Shimshin, a riddle is a metaphor that you don't know what it means. Me'az yatsa masok is a metaphor which presents one picture and it means something else. A metaphor means where I'm using a picture to convey a message that's within that picture. So Chazal, the deeper things that Chazal taught us, they taught us through a metaphor. And you need to learn every piece of Agarata. You need to get a sense in Rishonim and Adol Mefart. Aren't, unfortunately, is not enough on it. But the Maral is the one who made the biggest attempt to explain Agaritas, and he's written a tremendous amount and has most everything, and he guides you. Lamashal, there's a story in the Gemara about a man whose wife died, and he grew breasts and fed his son. And the Gemara says, what an incredible miracle. And the Gemara says, no, it's a terrible thing because God shouldn't be making such great miracles for a person. So he asks, is this meant to be literal or not? It goes back and forth using other halachic sources. It goes back and forth. In the end, he says, no, it didn't happen literally. What it means is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he had him find food for his kid and figure out what to give his kid, eggs or milk, whatever. So he asks, so why is it such a big miracle? And he says something incredible. He says, for a father to be able to take care of a son is a great miracle. Fathers don't do well. I see the married ones are laughing and the Barchen don't get it. But he says it's a nace count of mice abrasions that a father can raise a child. It's something against the nature. But here you have an example of a Agarata where he's willing to consider both options, and he decides on grounds of looking at the Chazal, what it means. So they're meant to be taken very seriously. Chazal didn't play games. But whether they spoke in metaphor or literal, each place is different. Let's get somebody new. You're a Talmud or Rebbe?
A Rebbe.
Okay. Well, can we get introduced?
Benjamin Steven.
Okay, say it.
Good friend of Moshe Walter.
Okay.
Two things. The Rosh Hashiva mentioned when he introduced the other Rosh Hashiva that Renassus, his brother-in-law.
Correct.
I think it would be amiss if we didn't hear a few words of maybe what we lost. And in general, what Rosh Hashiva thinks in terms of the situation of losing, of, you know, a lot of the Gedolim being on the Sefer Shtei Sifrim.
All right.
What it means for us in general, how we should look at it, what we should do. So
let me start with the flip side, more about Gedolim. Unfortunately, people have the impression that the purpose of Gedolim is to issue all sorts of statements or to ask them things and so on. I want to present another picture. I used to teach in Eshet Torah for a few years. I taught about 7 years there. And Reb Noach Weinberg, who was a giant in his own right, in his vision and his self-sacrifice was incredible, was the Rosh Yeshiva. A boy came into Yeshiva. I don't know where he came from. I don't know how he became from. But when he was in Yeshiva, he wore a bangusha. I think he might have had payas, sunglasses, and sneakers. And the rabbis were a little bit unhappy on that combination. And he was stubborn about it. That's what he wanted to wear. And they went to Reb Noach. And Reb Noach said, if he's not willing to change, he should leave. You know, either or. Either he wears tennis shoes, sunglasses, and shorts, or he wears a bekesha and pants and black shoes, but not the way he's wearing. So someone asked him, he's not doing anything wrong. What's the problem? And he answered, Reb Noach said, extraordinary insight. He said, people don't change because of ideas. They don't change because of dry arguments. They change because they see people. You walk into a tzibur, and you see a tzibur that you like what you see, the quality, you identify, you would like to identify them, that makes you... All the arguments in the world, they help you with issues, but at the end of the day, a person makes a decision based on people. What does it look like when you put it on? A suit looks nice in the window until you put it on. He said, somebody normal that will walk into here and see this guy, he will make a U-turn and walk out. And he said, so he's a road agent. That was the way he put it. All the lessons and all the learnings we do have an impact on us. It doesn't compare to the impact of seeing big people, living with big people. When I was 16, I was able to come from the yeshiva, and I finished high school. They didn't have any yeshivas with one-year programs or three-year programs. I mean, I was a big jump, but I came. And I saw Reb Nochum. And Reb Nochum's, just watching him learn, watching his thinking process, looking to see how he's immersed, looking at the glint in his eyes when he was saying a pshat, looking at the conviction, the passion that he's saying emes, made an impression on every single one of us of Avos HaTorah. Watching Reb Chaim Shulevitz, my father-in-law Zechariah Bracha, those were all things that left a profound impression because it was real. What it says in these, I believe Hashem said this, but do I really think people can act that way? No. But when you down deep, it's good, it's right, but we're humans and it's not that. But when you see somebody that's real and you sense emes in him, that's mashpia. And therefore, big people, Klal Yisrael can only become as big as the role models as they have. And that's why it says, L'kayim b'nu chachmi Yisrael. Just having presence. People don't know Rabbi Yashiv, and they can't know Rabbi Yashiv. He hasn't been public for many years. And the only smidges he get is bits of politics in there. When I came to Israel, he answered Shilas. But it was amazing. First of all, he was a natural masmid. He is a natural masmid. And he used to learn in Meisharim in a small shtiebel locked away most of the day. And you could see him from a window. And he sat with a Gemara, never took his head out, calmly going over the Gemara, the Rush, and Tosfos, and the Rif, and speaking it out, and saying it over. They have videos of him a few months ago doing the same thing. He was exactly the same. He was always calm, always collected, always approaching everything with Seichel and Das. People seem to know him as a Machmir. When I remember, he was able to be Mekel on many Shilas with extraordinary... Chachma, he was able to approach my situations, never lost, always would view it with what you see as what you would think Das Torah. He would always, he would never let himself get involved emotionally and always look what's the emes and how should it work and what should go. And it was impressive. It left the Roshim asking him a shaila, the seriousness that he took it with. So, Baruch Hashem, we were zochah to have people, it was unthinkable in my days to have people this age. In my day, somebody in his 80s was an old man. But Baruch Hashem was Zohar, and we should be Zohar more. But just understand the importance, because we'll never be bigger than a few exponents lower than the big people. And as long as we have big people, we have hope of being bigger. That's one part of it. We spoke about my brother-in-law. I mean, my brother-in-law was a striking person because when you look at Rabbi Yashar, you say, okay, he grew up in Yerushalayim, his grandfather's the Leshem, he was kind of born at Tzadik and Kadosh, and all the stories seem to go that way, so I admire it, but it's not me. My brother-in-law grew up American. It's America's apple pie. He grew up in Chicago, went to the modern school, and he had certain, he was not especially brilliant. He was intelligent, fine, but nothing special about him. He had some middos that were very special. And one of them was, he always wanted to do what's right. He was a person whose sense was, how hard it is not important. The question is, what's the right thing to do? He was a person that was never self-conscious. If he didn't know something, he would ask it over and ask it over. There was a complete emes to him. One of the reasons why he was so effective when he spoke Musar, he didn't say brilliant chidushim, but the sense of reality that came with it, and especially when his 20 years of being Rosh Yeshiva was with terrible, terrible difficulties because of his Parkinson's, the fact that it was so real was very, very powerful. You know, when he said there is nothing sweeter than learning, you felt every fiber of his body said it. It wasn't a speech to be prepared. It wasn't the right thing to say. It was him. And those are tchunis that I think apply to each and every one of us. Requires no talent in just the rutzen to do what's right. And the ability to persevere and to know that there's nothing important other than that. And it applied across the board when he needed to do from things and non-from things, when he needed to draw back. Those are all very, very... It was an extraordinary, powerful tekufa. It's something that's still amazing. Yes. I forgot who's... Now that one second, Dibs. You know, let's have a few. We'll go. Leif Chacham Yemino.
In the Gemara, in Megillah,
yeah.
It discusses the translation of Torah Nevi'im, and it seems as if God gave Haskama to the translation, at least of Torah, to Unkelus. So what gives, like, the Rosh Yerim as a right to disagree with the translation of the word if Unkelus had the Haskama ever?
Good. Let me tell you a story I once heard from Yaakov Galinsky. He's a maggid, still alive at Meir Vesrim. He used to be very popular, and it's all Yiddish, so it's not really Sicily. It's really Yiddish. He said, it says, by Arblazim and Azariah, Haradi Kivan Shivim Shana, Melozo Chisi Sheta Omar, and so on. And we say, Nagoda. So it says, the words are Kivan Shivim Shana, that he was going to become Rosh Yeshiva, he was very young, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu made his beard white to show you, you know, that they made the right choice in taking him instead of Rabbi Yeshua and so on. So he asked, what's that introductory note important for? I mean, what does he have to juice himself? Melefit say, I'm 70 years old, and I wasn't zeicher, they should say Kriya Shema Balelos until then. It means something. But what does it mean to say I'm like 70, which means I'm 18, and I lozo chisi? So he said, imagine somebody would come to you with a halachic sefer. With a sefer with a halachic. And you disagree with a point. And you pull out a haskama from the Vilna Gaon on it. You would shut up. Let's say he pulls out a haskama from the Rambam. You would crawl on the table. Let's say Moshe Rabbeinu had a haskama. He said, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah had a haskama from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a sign that he's roi to be Rosh Yeshiva. And he said it made no difference. Until I couldn't prove it with a pasuk, I wasn't accepted. Unkelus belongs, Targum of Torah belongs to the chelik of Torah that's called Torah Shebal Peh. And therefore it has different, it has the ability, it's one of the pirushim. There's a pirush of the balei taimim. In other words, sometimes the way the taimim are written in the pasuk gives it a different angle. There's room to say other pirushim. It's not the haskama that this is the only. It's a haskama that this is a pirush on Torah. It's the first pirush, but there's a makom to give other pirushim. Later on, for instance, Rashi will use sometimes Chazal to be mefarish the pasuk, and Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam will argue on him. Not because they're arguing on the Chazal, but they hold this. It's not an exclusive pirush to the pasuk. Pirush already belongs to Torah Shebal Peh, and it's Sovel Ayin Panim and so on. The nusach of the Chumash itself is fixed. You know, Akash Baruch gave one nisa. Torah Shabbat Peh already has memtes parim, ayin parim, and so on, and therefore there's makom for other Purushim as well. Because the timing will also be Sinai. Yes, let me see if we have somebody new here, or... Ah.
You say every day at the
Panim Chadashas. This is a Panim Chadashas. We have Ayin Panim, we have a Panim Chadashas. Yeah.
You say every day at the Harav Nash, you look in and create stuff from the kid, the Torah is supposed to be sweet. So what exactly is that? Is it like an intellectual stimulation? Or is it something that's a lot higher than that? And like, how do we accomplish it?
Okay. Down deep, if you ask ourselves, what are the things that are interesting to us? A person picks up a newspaper. So one person looks at the sports section. I know I'm dating myself by saying you pick up newspaper because nobody does that anymore. But on the old days, before there was an internet, people read a newspaper. You pick up a newspaper. One guy goes to the sports section. One guy opens to the stacks. Occasionally somebody looks at the international news. In my days, the comics were very popular and so on. So each person has an akuda that speaks to him. If a person takes a sefer and he's not interested in learning, it's because he feels no connection to it. Intellectual connection is a lower level than feeling a connection because it's important, significant, relevant to me, and so on. The Behar of Noh includes getting a connection to it because this is important to me. The person who picks up the stack pages to look at it, it's because he knows that everything he owns depends on it. He needs to make a decision, sell, buy, you know, whatever it is. So you want, the Haravna is to get a connection to her. Yes?
How does it work that there are different angels? Where does that come from?
It comes from... let me give you a muscle for it. A muscle.
How can it be right also?
Okay. We know, on the one hand, we say Hashem Echad. The sentence that sums up our belief in Akash Baruch Hu is Hashem Echad. On the other hand, we say Hashem Hashem Kel, Rachum Chanan Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed, Vemes, Notze Chesed, and so on. 13 different descriptions that are at loggerheads with each other. We speak about the Hashem Agdulah, Vagvud, Fres, all different midas HaKadosh Baruch Hu that are distinct. So the answer is as follows. The oneness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the true emes, but we can't understand how the God that brought Auschwitz into the world brought such a wonderful Shefa and Klal Yisrael. The two things don't work together. We understand each element. We understand there's an haga of mishpat, there's an haga of din, there's an haga of chesed, there's an haga of rachamim. To understand something, we look at it in different ways. Let me give you a mashal to what he's saying. A mashal I think we can relate to. If let's say you stop a person on the street and ask him, what do you think the solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is? And the person answers, drive all the Arabs out. Or drive the Jews out. Whichever person you have to pick up. And that opinion can be said in two ways. Where that's the sum total of what the person ever thought. And that would make it a very, very low level opinion. Or a person says, sit down, you have some time? Let's go through it. Here's the conflict, here are the different scenarios, here are the different possibilities, these are the advantages, disadvantages, why we should do this, why you should do that, and after all this, we've eliminated this, eliminated that, this is the solution. That has a lot of weight to it, because it's not a bottom line when there's no top line, it's a bottom line of a long understanding that situations are complex, seeing it from different angles, understanding it different ways, and then we say, okay, so this must be askana. It's a difference between somebody paskaling because he only saw Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, or somebody paskaling because he learned through an entire sugya, saw the machlokas nigmar, the machlokas we've shown him, the different sheets in achronim, and then there's a bottom line that we come out with. So the complexity of Torah gives us the understanding. The back and forth and the different, one way of looking is like this, one way of looking is like this, one way of looking is like this. When you come to a maskana then, there's emes to that. Yes.
You mentioned earlier that the reason that the yeshivish community sort of took a step back from the religious Zionist movement,
yeah,
out of fear that it would be absorbed by the secular Zionist,
yes,
movement. 64 years after the founding, or almost 64 years after the founding of the State of Israel, I think it's fairly clear that that's not going to happen. I mean, religious Zionism is thriving, the yeshivish world is, and secular Zionism is too. Why haven't they taken a step back towards religious Zionism?
So I think the feeling, again, I don't know, I can't be supposed to everybody, I think the feeling is many elements, their sense is that religious Zionism, as it's espoused today, as it's understood today, has elements that are not right, because, in other words, when does the state, the needs of the state override halacha? How much of your perspective is affected by the big whirlpool of what everybody believes, and therefore you swept along. It's very hard to set your own agenda and say, we feel this, we feel that, and still be part of something else. So there are many issues where the feeling is the idea that the state is as equally as important as the Torah, rather than being a manifestation of one of the things that Kadosh Baruch Hu wants from us, is significant. In other words, I would say the significant point here is there a parity, or is the pshat Torah is central and Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael is one limb of that, and having a normal state that creates that Yeshiv is a very important practical way of it. And I think the sentiment is that it has been swallowed up to some degree emotionally and ashkafically, and therefore very uncomfortable with it. But on the practical level, I do think people live in a country. I think there is an osmosis. I think like that, and Turkati thinks like that. So I think we're on good grounds. That, there's a sense people look at it as a state, they look at it as normal, they look at it as positive. Whether they express it or not, I do think ideas flow through osmosis.
Well, how could you reconcile the fact that I think history has sort of proven that without a Jewish state, the Jews won't fare well, and that in modern time, without a Messiah or a redemption of any sort, a Jewish state has to function in some secular ways?
On the first half of the statement, and again, I'm somebody who's personally very kosher to Israel. It was for 6 years I commuted back and forth because I didn't want to move my family to Chutz Laaretz, until at some point but I don't believe that statement that for reasons of security and survival, the state is critical. God, I mean, if somebody was selling life insurance, it would be cheaper for somebody living in the States or in New Zealand than somebody living here. It's not, I mean, we're precarious. We do live on Nissim. I don't believe, how far was Germany from taking over in World War II? I don't think it's natural that we'll survive better. Somebody else could make a good argument that having 1,000 communities in 1,000 different places gives better chance for survival. I do think it's important to have a state. I do think it's important. A state, I mean, that if you're living in Eretz Yisrael and you want to live in Eretz Yisrael, you want to be in Eretz Yisrael, you need to have a normal trappings, a functioning state. I mean, it's not a shtibel. You can't. A shtibel is not a place to live in. It's something that will take time, and I think people understand it. I mean, down deep, if you were to ask people who are very Haredi, what would you say if your party were to win a majority in the next election? And I think most people would quietly say, God forbid. Because I think they're well aware of the fact that this is a peace reaction. They're missing. It's a peace reaction that when they formed Agudas Yisrael in Europe, German Jewry was kind of close to modern orthodoxy in some ways. Polish Jewry was Chassidish. Lithuanian Jewry was Yeshivish. They wanted German Jewry involved, not because they shared all that much ideology. I mean, they did. They shared the center mission, but they recognized that running an organization with any magnitude requires people that have something other than a shtibl mentality. You need process, you need structure, you need things, and it's a slow roll because the firm community, the creative community, has not been used to it. I think it will happen. That's my feeling. I mean, let's check in 25 years. Let's say somebody knew somebody in the back there.
What are your thoughts about wearing tails?
It's interesting because I think it falls along the lines more of a deeper approach to halacha than anything else. There is a reluctance in the Haredi community of things that have no clear enough basis in halachic world, but make a lot of sense for other reasons to get into it or not to get into it. One way of looking at it is, it doesn't take away from the halacha. Let's say it's not the right chelus, you didn't really lose anything. There are fine indications that it makes sense to do it. The nature of the Haredi world is conservative. In other words, part of its strength and some of its weakness has been slow to make changes. There is an inertia that has served it well in many cases, and has hampered in other cases. So that's why the poskim in the Haredi world were kind of extremely, extremely indifferent to it. The Gemara doesn't fit all that well. We have no Masoros for it. Somebody's come along and claimed with it. The foot dragging is a normal part of it. And it's a part of a deeper psychology, which again has worked well in many cases and has hampered it in other cases. You know? Yes, you. Yes, you.
This is based off of, I guess, Max's question. On a very theoretical level, because of the, I guess, the current situation where, like, in Eretz Yisrael, there are different communities from all around the world, at least on a religious level, there are many different Ashkabas, many
right.
different Hagim have developed over centuries being those. Is the current situation where there is sort of like, you can enter a show and there are like five different Nusach, series of davening on the in the case medrash, or is that an ideal situation, or would there come a time where all these different Hagim would sort of have to be combined into a universal
So you know, there are two levels. On the one hand, in the time of a Beis HaMikdash, there'd be a Beis Nagadol, and they would decide all issues. On the other hand, the diversity of Shvatim is true, and I believe it's more than just where they lived and what business they took. I do believe Hasidic davening brings out a certain nuance, a Sephardi davening brings out a certain nuance, a Taimani davening brings out a certain nuance. I mean, in Kabbalah they speak about different sha'arim of tefillah, and I think on the one hand it's maddening that there's so many different nishchals and you have to cater to so many different, you know, if you want to sell falafel, you need so many different echsherim, if you're afraid to buy the lousy eight shekel falafel. But there is a beauty, at the end of the day, if you're true about it, you realize that every community has to offer something, the other one doesn't. I'm sure many of you have gone to Rav Aralach for kafis or something, and I'm sure many of your shkaf is different, but you also have to admire the genuine warmth and fire and passion in the dveikas and mitzvahs and the davening. And you walk down to the yeshiva, and our shkaf might be slightly different, but you have to admire the passion of learning and so on. And you have to come down here and admire people who are true professionals and in front of their professions, unabashed about the Yiddishkeit, about the Torah, and are learned. If you're a little open-minded and a little open-hearted, you say, you know, this is where I belong. Let me look at the beauty here. Let me look at the beauty here. Let me take it in. I'm kind of horrified that we would all become one in the sense of, you know, homogenized. I would like to see people get along with each other and recognize why they need each other and understand this is where I need to lean on him and this is where he needs to lean on me. But the sense of the bickering about it and the me having to be better than you always is something that's bothersome. But the beauty... Yes, sorry. Okay, next. Let me see if any new faces here.
Sorry.
Yes.
One of the Rishis, they both talk about his yeshiva, but also maybe as an intro, just to speak about what the Rishis of Hashkafas are in terms of Torah and Derech Eretz, or how much value should Bachur nowadays place on secular subjects when they're exposed to so many other things? How much secular subjects should they be involved in? And obviously with the learning, so maybe it'll be a Pesach for the Rishis to speak about.
Okay, I guess that's what I'm here for, I supposedly. But I'll express myself a little more freely about why I see things. Let me start with an anecdote again. I guess there was a leader of the National Religious Party named Dr. Josef Berg. Dr. Josef Berg was a brilliant man. He was German. He had studied in the Rabbinah seminar. He was the head of Mizrahi. He was a brilliant politician, really, really brilliant. People might know of his son Avrom Berg, who was very different. His son Avrom Berg is, first of all, very, very left wing, and Avrom Berg is also a very provocative person. His father was the master politician. He always was able to keep everybody together somehow, patching up things. And he was a really, really exceptional person in that way. And someone asked him, Dr. Berg, the National Religious Party, right? National, Religious Party. Which is really the more important segment? The national or the religious? And he answered the hyphen. And which is something that I disagree with. And my feeling is, and this is my shita and hashkafa is, we say Hashem is echad, which means he's not a hyphen. Hashem, there is one elokus in the Bria. And our job is to become dovek in it, to express it, and so on. The primary tool for that is Torah. Learning it, practicing it, living it. But it's meant to take the entire world around. Kadosh Baruch Hu didn't create one thing in the world that's not meant to be expressed, that the Torah is not meant to express in it. And therefore, a person's growth should start internally, where a person develops by understanding, knowing Torah, passionate, and so on. And then a person needs to broaden for many reasons. A, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made different people will have different roles in life. One person will be a farmer, one a doctor, one a rav, one a shochet, and one a tzaddik nister, and one an army a soldier. Each and every person has a makom where talent, circumstance, and so on places him, and that's a tafkid. A person should be able to express his Torah in it. There is value in other knowledges because Torah comes to us. The world, just like everything in the world, is a levush of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Any science that's true is an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But, and let me tell you, and again, I know the Moisid here, it says on it Grus, it says on it Wayu, I want to express a difference where, an honest difference, and something, just another opinion. In my mind, an institution like YU, if they were honestly pursuing Torah Mada in a way that is Torah, the Rabbanim and the Hezi University would sit down and they would decide what does the Torah want, what is needed to give a person that sense of Torah in the world. And we would choose the courses and disciplines that we honestly believe make a curriculum. If you take the curriculum of Harvard and just take it over wholesale, you're not making that decision. Harvard is not Derech Eretz of Torah. Harvard is Harvard. Honest Derech Eretz of Torah, Rav Shamshon Paul Hirsch, when he made his Torah in Derech Eretz schools, he set the curriculum from A to Z. And he decided which poetry is good to read, and which poetry is also to read, and which poetry some people should read, and what the course of study. In other words, genuine, if Mada and Derech Eretz are meant to express it, what's a good profession to go into? Well, the world thinks, let me tell you something fascinating. Reb Aaron Kotler, I know this firsthand from a grandson. Reb Aaron Kotler was the Miasta of Lakewood. He was fired against college. And, you know, then he put in a sheet of learning without help. His daughter was brilliant. She was a genius in her life. Had a very troubled, she got divorced and was very troubled, and she wanted to go to university, and he agreed, and he said she can go for any profession except for one. Would anyone give me a guess at what profession he felt she shouldn't go to school for? I have high doubts anyone would guess. Some people would say biology, evolution, this, that.
Art.
What?
Art.
I don't think I knew what art was. That's the truth. but no. And it, what?
Psychology.
No.
Well,
yes. He said, because it teaches you to lie, and sheker is the worst thing in the world. The only thing that's not redeemable is, I think she actually did go to law school. She tried to run. I know the family well. She tried to run. She was a politician. She ran for office. She was highly unsuccessful because she was a very honest person, ruthlessly honest. And she told everybody what they didn't want to hear, so it was a no-go. And I know the grandchild, I know her children, we're close friends. That's where I heard the story from her son, from the Zayda said anything but locus dishlai. That's an expression of a Torah Ashkafa. In other words, it's for a lawyer does it is respectable. He sits in an office and this and that, and it's fine. And to have an Ashkafa, and it doesn't have to be the only Ashkafa, but really to have that Ashkafa and say, how is this profession doable? Can I express Torah values in it? And it's a fascinating, so my personal sense is, I think everyone needs the primacy of Torah. Let me tell you another anecdote, which again, I resonates well. This I heard from someone who heard it from the person himself. I heard this from a chav of mine who heard it from an old man in Muncie in the 70s. When this person was 15 years old, his father felt that he was very bright, and he took him to the Ors Sameach for a b'china, and he asked him what should he do with him. And he was hoping he would say he tested him. Obviously, the boy was good, but not fantastic. The Ors Sameach tested him, and he told him he's not bad. He could use another 2 or 3 years of learning, and then find a malacha kala nekiya for him to go into. His father went home. He cried for 3 days and 3 nights that his son doesn't have what it takes to be a gadol. He sent him to learn for 2 or 3 years and sent him on from Locha Kal Nekia. This old man told my friend, what we're missing today are gadolim that will tell someone to learn for 2 or 3 years and then do Locha Kal Nekia, and parents that will cry when you tell them your son can only be a very good doctor. He'll never make it as an other gadol. That's the second part that's missing. And it's a very hard balance. If you're honest, to be able to keep the fire of what's emes and ikar in life, and yet to do what's right for you, with the recognition that somewhere along the line, it's the Moshe Rabbeinu on top of the mountain that's emes, and you're kind of doing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do, but it's not there, that's tough. And can I say we do it? Let me tell you one of the stories that moved me the most as a mechanech. We have boys, we have a handful of boys that went back to Israel at Fishinger College and are still sitting and learning. Three of them had chaburis in the Mir, and that's a pride. There are a handful, I would say a dozen or a dozen and a half, that have very successful rabbanis in another dozen or so in Chinuch. That's a very, very big source of pride. One boy who was not any of those, he was a real live wire, full of life, fun. He was the kind of guy that just sort of held on to. I mean, he learned, he's smart, but it was always a struggle to keep him one place for a very long time. He was full of life, energetic, very geschmack, and always kept the kesha. He comes from a very poor family. His parents are very, very poor. They're mechanchim, and they literally have no bread on the table. He went to work for himself. First of all, he needed to work. He didn't have any money, and also his personality was that for so many years we'd learned, we still kept very close. Like all Talmidim keep very close. He calls me up one day, he was in New York, and he says, I'm in a business. He does very well. It was an internet business run by Orthodox people. And he feels what they're doing borders on Gzela. Certain very dishonest practices. What do I think? I should pass them. And he told me what they do. So I started scratching my head, and I said, okay, so what's your role in it? And do you actually tell a person X and this and that? And I kept trying to figure out, where does a Pesach to tell them that it's okay to do it. Very soon into the process, he told me, Rebbe, if it says, if it's not glatt, if it's as complicated as that, then I'm not interested in it. And he quit. He quit without knowing where next month's rent is going to come from. He quit knowing that his parents are sitting in a town someplace waiting for some of his money. And he said, if it's not honest, it's not for me. If you need that level of complication to try to weasel a hat or ass for me, I'm not going there. He got a job the same night, and that's that part of the story doesn't, you know, I'm not, that part of the story, I don't, you know, that my first part of it's not important. What's important is, so this is an example of Torah and Derech Eretz, where the person over there is able to walk away from something. I might have, if I would have asked enough questions, maybe I would have gotten to some point where I could figure out if you do X but not Y and not responsible for Z, maybe with the evidence it's not a problem. But he said, it's not right. This is not the life I want to live. And it can't be this what Kosh Baruch wants for me. That takes a lot. We have one of our students who's brilliant. He was really, he's very, very smart. He finished Brown University and came to us, learned about 5 years. Then he went to law school. Still lives in the community. He says a shir every night. And he had a really difficult choice. He could work private in a private law firm, make a lot of money, live nicely, but basically it means there's no real quality time for himself or for his family. Or he could work for the government where the salaries top in the early hundreds, 120, 130 is basically as far as you get. The head of a department might make the 150. It's really not. And he has can hire 4 kids, going to school, tuition stuff, but he has a life. And he agonized. And other people told him, nah, it's no money, it's peanuts, you have to go private and that. And he sat with me, worked it through, and he told me, you know, he thought long and hard about it. He said, I'm not going to sell my life away. He said, whatever it needs to make do, it's doable on the salary. It's always tight. I have no perks because I'm a lawyer. I have no extra vacations because it takes for Chol HaMoed. But that's Torah Deheretz. When you make those tough decisions and apply it, and I would hope that's the type of message. It's not enough to say, we'd like you also to be a lawyer. We'd like to be a real Ben Torah when you're a lawyer. And we have to make some very, it's easier to be poor as a cold person than as a lawyer. Because people have rachmanis on a cold person who's poor, they have no rachmanis on a lawyer who's poor. When you come and say, I'm a Rebbe, you can have a tuition reduction, then people will say, oh, of course. If you come and say, I'm a lawyer, could I have a tuition reduction? People say, go work. You know, like I didn't tell you to work for Uncle Sam. I mean, you know, there's a $600,000 job waiting. Why you make only $150? I should pick up the tab for you. You know, this guy has got a long beard. He's a Rebbe, okay. But, you know, you face that. And it's a big Nisayan. And so Baruch Hashem, it's something that we would like. You know, people spend about, on the average, about 5 years in yeshiva. And what we like to see is a tremendous amount of growth, and there's a sort of bridging. They sort of, a lot of people settle around the yeshiva, and as they're getting into real life and they're facing so many issues, we're there. They feel connected to yeshiva, connected to Rebbeim, and this is really where the testing ground is. Whatever you've learned here is the beginning. Any questions? Yes.
Okay, so according to my understanding, the mitzvah of having Torah on our mind is constant, right?
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you could speak about how do we know...
I don't know what the Olam schedule is. I mean, I don't...
Whatever the issues are.
You know, I can go. It's just that if you're interested, I'm fine, yes. By the way, I'm very impressed with the caliber of curiosity and the honesty of the questions and the... you know, the scope of the questions, it really says a lot about the group. I mean, it is very impressive, I must tell you. I am very impressed. Yes? Okay, fine. Okay, yes.
How do we know the point at which we should be learning Torah and the point at which we're taking a break for a spell? The further the question, how do we know if it's laziness that's encouraging a certain decision or not? And like you said, if you learn 100 blocks, you should learn 200. So shouldn't that be the mindset of keep go? And even further that, the more we learn, the more God will help us in our learning, right? It's linear in the sense.
Let me tell you something. The Rambam says that just like there are rofei aguf, there are rofei nefesh, and a person should consult chachamim about inyanim of midos. So someone once asked, well, isn't that obvious? It's just like if you don't know Hilchas Shabbos, you ask somebody who knows Hilchas Shabbos. Why on Midas does he say it differently? So I once thought as follows. It's possible to learn Hilchas Shabbos and to make your own decisions. A person could pass him himself if he's a Bar HaRoah and it's, and so on. Midos, you can never ever test yourself and really know are your midos off or not. Moshma Dabadaima, you can't, if you think your computer's been affected by a virus, the computer will not be the instrument to tell you if it's affected by a virus or not. You'll take an outside disk or connect it to some outside thing and it's gonna look at it. On personal decisions, in general, unless you have a Rebbe or a good Chava, let's take an example. A person pushes himself, like you say. Am I obsessive compulsive, or am I just trying to get the best out of myself? If you're obsessive compulsive, you're going to think about yourself that I'm lazy and just trying to get the best out of myself. That's how your mind is going to work. You need to someone else to say, listen, I really see on you, it's an obsession. It's not healthy. And you need somebody to calibrate your own mechanism. The job of a Rav on personal growth is to take care of those issues. Anything that we're warped in, we're going to see as straight. A ruler that's bent will always be telling you it's straight because it's a straight edge. So you need something else. There's nothing as important as having a Rebbe, in the sense, a mentor that can tell you these things. He can tell you, listen, you can push yourself a little bit more, and you need to push yourself a bit more, or it's not healthy. You don't allow yourself to breathe, you don't allow yourself to be natural, and you just have some sort of mechanism of being a guilt conscious or obsessiveness or whatever it is. The bottom line is, in growth and personal growth and so on, a Rav is the most important thing, simply because it's the one area of Torah you can't do yourself. Art scroll can even get you a Yerushalmi. You can even learn Yerushalmi through art scroll. You can never learn about yourself. When you read books, self-help books in psychology, the problem is, but you're the nutcase. So you know, it says the Heiliger book, if a person is overly paranoid about people around him, he's paranoid, borderline, whatever it is. I say, I'm not overly concerned. I'm with a bunch of criminals here. This is not, I wouldn't call this overly paranoid. This is, you know, everyone's out to kill me. So you know, the problem is, it's the one area where you need a person. And that's why a yeshiva, wherever yeshiva chooses to, ask yourself, do I have a Rebbe there that I can touch base with? You don't have to ask every Narashvet, but in the general, somebody that will help you ask yourself, you know, when those important questions, what should I be doing with myself? Where am I going? Do I need to be sort of evened out on that? Aseh Lecha Rav, I think, is a very good way to end the session with. Batzlocha, and once again, I'm very, very impressed with Dailog. And you should very much learn and learn as much as you can. And there's no terrible occurrence as Yisrael. It would be awesome. It would be a key requisite to Mrs. Sessing. I don't know if it would be a thing, but it's Mrs. Sessing to wear it. And
so it would be 100% proof.
Yes, the answer to that would be yes. The problem is, it's a tourism difficult to get the Gemara to fit. But the reality doesn't mean this, doesn't mean that. I don't know. It's something that may take hold. I'm going to be surprised if it slips into one group in the greater world, it will start spreading. And that's why I think it's one of these things, wait and see. I mean, Hasidus had a lot of his nights, and then it became part of mainstream. What's your name?
Shmuel Berkowitz.
Where you from?
Rockaway.
New York. Yes.
Two questions.
Where did you go for high school?
Unfortunately, Hebrew Academy. I actually left there a year early. I should be in 12th grade right now. I couldn't do it anymore. It wasn't a good place for me. So, retrospect, I probably should have gone to Yeshiva Greater Washington. But actually, two questions. First of all, with regards to your Yeshiva, during the summer, does it have...
There are people in the summer. A big part of the Tzibah stays in the summer. And if you come in the summer, we'd be very happy to accommodate you.
Is it an all-day thing, or is it just possible if you...
In the summer, each Seder is there. You know, it is the morning Seder, afternoon Seder, you do one or the other. Are you going home for Pesach or not?
No.
You're not going home. It's the summer. So, cool when you're there, and there are enough people around that there's a real Seder going on. Most of the summer.
And it's easy enough to get there. So.
Yeah.
But actually, I had a question. So, we in Shemini and then in Yuma, it talks about Tim Jumalev being a big issue with regards to Avera.
Right.
And then everyone nowadays, though, everyone is always talking about, oh, when you eat bugs, Tim Jumalev. Eat bugs, Tim Jumalev. Everyone really focuses on Tim Jumalev with regards to eating bugs. And then in Parshas Mishpatim, the Ramban focuses in on, says that when you eat non-kosher stuff, when you eat treif, then that's Tim Tumalev. So why do we have such a huge focus on Tim Tumalev with the rest of bugs, and Ramban only focuses in on the treif instead of the Avera?
I think it's because it's just a nisayon of our door, so people like to bring in the argument. People feel that the real treif people today are not so. Very few people order shrimp unless they're really not from. Bugs feels okay, it's lettuce, it's nuts. I think it's used more to get people in a certain direction.
But it's not about treif. The big Tim Jumalev is
correct.
With regards to Avera. So how is it going from Avera to that really specific case? That's my, I mean, I just.
I think they feel because they're